Daniel Gezelbash, Hannah Martin, and Laura Smith-Khan are researchers from the University of Sydney's law faculty. Between them, they share extensive experience and expertise in refugee law. As part of his doctoral research, Daniel has found an international trend of deterrence in asylum seeker policymaking.
I argue that there's been competition among countries that have traditionally been receiving refugee populations to develop new policies within the framework of the Refugee Convention that sort of push the boundary in terms of limiting access to those protection procedures.
Hannah places this in the Australian context.
Australia has had quite a unique experience of people seeking asylum in that for many, many years, indeed until about, I think probably the 1970s or 80s, we didn't have people turning up on our borders and seeking to be admitted as asylum seekers. We had people who were refugees, but we admitted them via what we would call resettlement programs. So that was when Australia went into the refugee camps after World War II and selected people who we'd like to take. And that still goes on. And I think that that idea of selecting people from overseas who are waiting in a camp, that's really ingrained in Australians' views of refugees. We have this idea that the people who are waiting in camps are the good refugees, the ones that we're happy to have, the real refugees, quote unquote.
Looking at the government's Papua New Guinea agreement first, then the opposition's Operation Sovereign Borders, I asked Daniel, Hannah and Laura to share their thoughts on the lawfulness of these policies.
The convention doesn't just define who is a refugee, although that's perhaps the most important thing. It sets out all the obligations that estates have to people who are refugees and to people who are claiming to be refugees. So the most important one of those is that a country who has signed the convention won't send somebody back to where they face persecution. So Papua New Guinea has agreed to that. But what they haven't agreed to is a whole range of other rights, economic rights, social rights, and really basic things like education for children. So that's at an international level, their promise to do that is absent. Now, in the Memorandum of Understanding between Australia and Papua New Guinea, there is an agreement by Papua New Guinea that it will provide these things. So that the government has said in quite general terms, we will provide adequate standards of living, education. But I guess the real practical concern is how are they actually going to do this? Because PNG is a country with limited resources, not least because the areas they're starting to put the refugees in are quite remote and not as well developed. So I guess there's the legal question, and then there's the practical question.
Just going on from what Hannah said, there's also questions about the legally binding nature of the agreement between Australia and Papua New Guinea, and the document is very clear to state that it's a memorandum of understanding that doesn't create any enforceable legal obligations. So if Papua New Guinea was to violate any of these undertakings, nor Australia nor anyone else will be able to hold them accountable in any way.
And also then looking at what the Liberal Party has released.
Two of the key policies they have I'm going to address. One is this idea of turning boats around. It's basically just not possible to do without cooperation of Indonesia. And Indonesia has made it very clear that they don't want to do it. And it's also very dangerous, and it's proven to be very dangerous in the past. And the second policy is temporary protection visas. And we had them in the late 1990s early 2000s, and the experience there was that they actually had the opposite effect, which they increased the number of people trying to get here, and that's because they removed family reunification rights for holders of the temporary visas, and we had boats filled with women and children trying to get here, whereas in the past the family head would come and they'd be resettled. You had the horrible incident in 2001 with the sinking of the Sieve X, where 353 people perished, the majority of them being women and children.
However, policies of deterrence have proven ineffective in stopping asylum seekers from taking the dangerous journey to Australia by boat.
One of the big problems here is that there is greater awareness about Australia's policies, but this message of the dangers of the journey isn't being driven home. There's always there's a lot of misrepresentation on the part of the people smugglers, and although there's these stories of these boats sinking get told and passed around, there's always this the people smugglers saying that my product is different. I have a luxury boat. I'm going to charge you more. I'm going to issue you with a boarding pass, like a cruise liner boarding pass. You're going to have a berth, like life jackets. It's going to be a luxury boat. And then by the time they get to boarding the boat, and it's this old fishing boat filled to the brim, they don't have a choice. Either get on or they lose their money.
And it seems incredible to us, but there are stories coming out of Indonesia of people who genuinely believe that they've been sold a ticket on like a P&O cruise to Australia.
Yeah, we've heard that story many times from clients that we've represented here, who've made it to Australia. That's what they were told.
Having conducted field research in refugee camps and spoken to several refugees, Laura explains why asylum seekers might choose to take the risk of travelling to Australia by boat.
Within the Australian context, it's often brought up that people in detention have a really hard time dealing with the indefinite nature of that. So not knowing what's going to happen and when can really, really affect your mental health. And that's just as true when you're waiting overseas. So if you're in a situation where you've got no idea when you're going to get your refugee status, when or if you're going to be resettled, where you're going to go, how long it's all going to take, and where it differs from person to person. So you might see another family getting their status or being resettled much quicker than you. And just that uncertainty, I think, is really, really difficult for people to live with and really, really affected their mental health.
When Laura went to Indonesia, she was telling me the time between presenting yourself at the UNHCR office and even being asked to come back and get your name, give your details.
Yeah, just basic registration.
Months, bordering on years. I'm certainly not defending, you know, the people smugglers, but you can see how just putting yourself in the shoes of someone who is in Indonesia without status, without work rights, subject to be detained at any time, if you actually just take a step back and consider what their motivations are, you can understand how someone might make a calculated assessment of the risk and think, well, it's here for innumerate numbers of years with no status, or take the risk.
Having people travelling to Australia by boat and risking their lives and perishing at sea isn't a good thing, but it's a matter of coming up with a viable alternative where these people can reach safety and have durable solutions without having to risk their lives.
One of the reasons why I think people who, for example, get to Indonesia but then don't stay is because what is in Indonesia is not, to use the phrase Dan just used, a durable solution. And that's what UNHCR talks about, and that's what they look for. And so it is hard for Australia, being the only country, the main country in the region that actually has signed the convention and is really in a position to offer these kind of durable solutions. So in an ideal world, the countries around Australia would also have signed the convention. And that would create, I think, a very different dynamic of people coming to Australia or perhaps not even seeking to come to Australia.
So, for example, when I was in Pakistan, you know, it's got the biggest refugee population in the world. It's over 1.7 million Afghans are living in Pakistan. And most of them don't want to be resettled somewhere. Most of them just stay there and live and try and set up a life there. So what's important in those kind of situations, I guess, is looking at how aid and kind of supporting development in the world, I guess, in general, but also focusing on particular countries where there are large displaced populations, how that can make a more durable situation for the people living in those countries.